human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we look at the American deep state in the Trump era. We're joined by two scholars who have spent a long part of their career looking at the deep state and America's secret government. We're joined by Peter Dale Scott and David Talbot. Please stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we take a timely look at an historic topic that's been overlooked far too often, certainly by corporate media, but also by many scholars and others, even on the left of the spectrum. We're looking at the deep state, and today's guests are experts about deep state affairs and issues, and they are, of course, returning guests to the Project Censored Show. Peter Dale Scott is a former Canadian diplomat and professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. He's a leading political analyst and poet. His books include Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, Drugs, Oil, and War, The United States in Afghanistan, Colombia, and Indochina, The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America. And he's been awarded the Land and Poetry Award. His website can be found at peterdalescott.net. Peter Dale Scott, welcome back to Project Censored.
Good to see you again, Mickey.
And also we're joined by David Talbot. David Talbot is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, and the acclaimed national bestseller, Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. He was the founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon.com and was a senior editor at Mother Jones Magazine and the features editor of the San Francisco Examiner. He's written for The New Yorker, The Rolling Stone, Time, The Guardian, and other major publications. And most recently, he is a thrice weekly columnist at the San Francisco Chronicle. His most recent book is The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David Talbot, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Good to be here.
So, Peter Dale Scott, let's begin with you. The issue of the deep state has been all over the corporate media and has infiltrated political discourse of late, certainly since the election of Donald Trump, or the electored presidency of Donald Trump, perhaps more accurately put. Can you start out by explaining to us, given your long roots and scholarship in the deep state, can you give our listeners a brief overview of sort of the historic trajectory of what you see as this deep state?
If I could begin with what they're saying now, and then I will say
sure.
Why I think that the term is being directed away from where it should really be. You know, the Trump campaign ran against Washington, promised to drain the swamp, and some of his supporters, starting back in August, started talking about the deep state and how Trump was going to clean it up. And recently, with all these leaks, particularly with the resignation of Flynn, Michael Flynn, with the National Security Advisor, a top appointment, and he lasted 24 days. This is really quite a startling event. And both sides in this conflict between Trump and Washington tried to spin that as an affair of the deep state, the Trump people attacking the deep state. And then you had three very similar stories coming out in traditional CIA outlets, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the LA Times. The LA Times piece was by Doyle McManus, who's carried water for the CIA before when the CIA wanted to destroy the reputation of Gary Webb, who had revealed about drugs and the Contras. Doyle McManus was in charge of a 17-man team at the LA Times. They were called the Get Gary Webb team in-house. And they, too, are talking about the deep state, but they're trying to shrink the deep state down. So it's a way of talking about what I call the Beltway agencies, NSA, CIA and the companies that they outsource to, like SAIC and Booz Allen Hamilton. In my own book, The American Deep State, that's an important part of the deep state, but certainly doesn't begin to get the full measure of this nexus, very amorphous and fluid and always changing power, what T. Wright Mills called a power elite. But I think that I would distinguish what I'm saying from his. First of all, I say that the deep state is not a structure. That's a mistake that many people make, I think. There was one article recently by a man called Edward Curtin. I liked his conclusion, but he was talking about the deep state got together and planned an attack. No, that's not possible. You're talking about something as huge as a weather system, as amorphous as a weather system, and potentially as dangerous as a weather system. It's more like a process than an actual structure. And, you know, seeing I brought up C. Wright Mills, I would just say that C. Wright Mills tended to stress the unity of interests in the power elite, and that's what gave them their power. I see the deep state as really much more conflicted than that. There are contending forces. You have old wealth, new wealth, corporate wealth, personal wealth. And back in the time of the Kennedy assassination, there was talk about the Yankees and the Cowboys and how the Sun Belt was different from Wall Street. All of these different ways of slicing it are true and different and balance each other out to some extent. America is very, very diverse, was at the beginning, coalition of slave states and non-slave states, which began the country with huge problems of racism that we're still trying to deal with. I think we're slowly making some progress there. So I would say that you think of the power elite and then think of something that's not structured, not unified, but is power behind the scenes. And you can quote any number of presidents who have acknowledged that they're just the president in the White House and there are other powers. That's the problem of getting a constitution that limits power. Right now, I'm very glad we have a constitution that limits power because it may steer us through what otherwise could be a very, very ugly period of American history. But if you're limiting public power with a constitution, then you get a legacy of private power that is not so limited. There are no constitutional rules for private power. And, you know, I think the historic role of progressives is to try and create rules that limit the amount of money that corporation can give to a political campaign, things like that. And unfortunately, we've seen a lot of those rules being broken and thrown away recently, and that's part of our current crisis. David, would you agree with that?
Yeah, David Talbot, chime in here, please.
Well, I certainly agree that there's been a shrinking of the definition of the deep state in the current media hullabaloo about all this, and that's for good reason. The corporate media is part of the deep state. It doesn't want to include itself. It's something else. It's something limited. It's the CIA, the NSA, as Peter said, and that's about it. But no, it's much broader. And you're right, C. Wright Mills, who was the great, I think, scholar of the deep state during the Cold War period, the Columbia University sociologist, in his, I think, landmark book, The Power Elite, that Peter referenced earlier, defines it much more broadly and includes Wall Street. It includes key industries like the oil industry. It includes the corporate media. It's not just a few national security types in Washington. Now, what he did say was that in that period, there was a key sector of the power elite, and that was these men, and they were virtually all men in those days, who shuttled between Washington and Wall Street, like Alan Dulles, who I focus on in my book, The Devil's Chessboard, and others. And these were kind of the glue that held together sort of the ruling circles. They popped up in the same social clubs. They sent their kids to the same elite prep schools. And they were very coordinated group. And you don't have, I think, in those days, quite as much of the factionalism as you have today within these ruling circles. And I think what we're seeing now is the struggle for the Trump administration, not just against the Trump administration, not just the backlash from the national security state, which we're obviously seeing, but also even this internal struggle within the Trump administration to define it and which one of these groups is going to control it. Michael Clare, who's been a frequent guest on Pacifica Radio as well, scholar in Hampshire College. He just wrote a piece recently for The Nation magazine defining these factions as the billionaires versus the bombardiers. So you have the sort of more traditional corporate and finance people who are obviously represented within the Trump administration. And then you have these ideologues, these new ideologues who are against global treaties, who are against internationalism, are much more nationalistic and extremist in those views, Steve Bannon and so on, versus the Rex Tillerson. Those two men, I think, are the emblematic figures in some ways in this new emerging Trump administration, Steve Bannon, the extremist nationalist, who comes out of Wall Street, ironically, himself. He worked at Goldman Sachs. But he was, I think, always a maverick figure there. And Rex Tillerson, the former head of Exxon, who, of course, has an internationalist perspective because Exxon is built on that. And wants good relations with Russia and Putin for commercial reasons, not just ideological ones, perhaps. So I think that it's a very interesting struggle that's going on right now. As a scholar, a journalist, you can sit back and sort of marvel at this. But unfortunately, as a citizen of the United States, there's some frightening implications because the country is up for grabs. I think the Russian hysteria, the hysteria about a so-called Russia hack of our democracy, which I think is incredibly over-exaggerated and overplayed by the media, has taken over, really, the debate within the Democratic Party and in the media. And I think in doing that and trying to use that as a way to, you know, destabilize Trump and even perhaps drive him out of office, the Democrats have become a one-issue party. And that wing of our ruling elite is deserting the American people in many ways by overly focusing on Russia and not focusing on the issues that are so urgently important to us, the healthcare system, which is now being perhaps overhauled and demolished by Republican ideologues like Paul Ryan, immigration, the EPA and every major agency and department in the government being taken over by critics of those agencies, by corporate lobbyists who are out to destroy.
Steve
That's
Bannon's.
The Bannon line.
Yeah.
That's right. Anyway, so I just think, just to wrap up, that is the real issue that we should be focusing on, and not this, in some ways, red herring of Russia. The Democrats and liberals, of all people, have revived the old Cold War Red Scare campaign in a desperate effort to attack Trump and put him on the defensive, and I think it really is playing with fire.
What has really distressed me, that a lot of quite intelligent intellectuals, both in the New York Review and in, most recently in the New Yorker, are part of this campaign that you're talking about, David. There was a very long article about Trump and Russia in the New Yorker. There were some good things in the article. It wasn't by idiots foaming at the mouth, but I was very disturbed to see the undercurrent tone was almost a fear that the Trump administration is not going to be bellicose enough, and lamenting that one heroine in the article, this woman Evelyn Farkas, who had resigned from the Pentagon because Obama wasn't activist enough and she joined Hillary's campaign. They want Hillary without Hillary, and it's hard to look for good things that have happened recently. But Hillary wanted a no-fly zone in Syria. That would have meant confrontation with Russia and the possibility of a war. And what's happened instead is that it's clear that Russia and Turkey and America are sitting down together what to do. And the result is there's a focus on getting ISIS out of Raqqa, and America's going to put 400 troops into Syria, and you don't hear any objections from Russia. You also, what you don't hear, and certainly it was not what being emphasized, is that Trump, by doing this kind of focus on ISIS, seems to be quietly forgetting about the old Obama campaign to get rid of Assad, which Hillary would definitely have wanted to do. And everyone's talking about how dangerous Trump is, but there are a lot of different dangers, and I think one of the worst dangers in the last campaign would have been that we would have had Hillary, who would have proceeded with a very aggressive campaign in Ukraine and, above all, a very aggressive campaign in Syria. this is where I think it's helpful to come back and think about the deep state, because like you said, David, the deep state is represented inside the Trump administration. And there are, as Jane Mayer wrote about in Dark Money, a very, very good book, by the way, very good book. She was talking about all these people who line up with the Koch brothers to put money behind the Tea Party and essentially not so much capture the Republican Party as destroy the Republican Party, and have pretty much destroyed the Democratic Party too in the same process, also very polarized. Well, what she did say, something I think is very important, is that although a lot of these people aligned with the Tea Party and the Kochs, they represent new money, personal money, not corporate money, but also they are the heirs to the old America First faction that was in the Goldwater movement. The difference is that when the Goldwater people were around, when Mills wrote The Power Elite, but they were very marginal, very, very marginal, and they are not marginal now. There's huge money behind them. And because it's personal money, they can do things corporations can't. The Kochs, for example, they're worth something like $80 billion. If they put $1 billion into politics to get an improved tax rate on their income, they get a very good return on that investment. And that's a huge investment to corrupt the political system. And that is the real problem we have. We have great disparity of wealth now, and a lot of that wealth is trying to trash the traditional government of this country, because it's trying to put restraints on them and their wealth that they don't want.
That's the voice of Peter Dale Scott, author of The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. We're also joined by David Talbot, author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, The CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. I'm Mickey Huff. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We'll return to the program after a brief musical break and continue our conversation about the American Deep State. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. We're joined today by scholar Peter Dale Scott, author of numerous works on American politics and the deep state. One of his more recent books is The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy from 2015. We're also joined by author and journalist David Talbot, author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, The CIA, and The Rise of America's Secret Government. You can also see David Talbot's columns three times a week at the San Francisco Chronicle. David Talbot, let's go to you. You've been writing about many of these things in the Chronicle, actually, of late, which is fantastic because we're getting some different perspectives than we're used to seeing in that outlet. And, of course, you had a conversation with Peter Dale Scott some weeks back about deep state issues and the Trump administration. But I wanted to riff momentarily on something that you brought up earlier, the infatuation of the Democratic Party and the corporate news media attacking Trump and Putin. And it's not just the Democratic Party. Like we saw earlier in the primaries last year, and then through the candidacy of Trump and the nomination of Donald Trump, there's definitely unrest in the Republican Party. Particularly, you write in one of your articles not long ago, the hubbub for a coup on the left and right, growing louder by the day. And you note that William Kristol, neoconservative anti-Trump position, is among those who has tweeted his secret longing to be saved by Big Brother. And you write, quoting him, saying, obviously strongly prefer normal democratic and constitutional politics, but if it comes to it, prefer the deep state to the Trump state. Unpack that for us momentarily. What are you saying that Kristol is saying about the deep state and Trump in that regard?
It's that he feels so marginalized, he and the neoconservative sort of wing of the Republican Party by the Trump administration, that he's prepared to go as far as sanctioning an overthrow of the democratically elected government of the United States. It's a cynical and cavalier attitude that unfortunately is shared widely within the political and media elites, not just on the right, on the left, too. You have James Wolcott, the longtime columnist for the Vanity Fair, also in his kind of snarky way, suggesting that he too would support such a coup and attacking what he calls the alt-left, people like me, I suppose, for criticizing the view that we should have a new Cold War, a new Red Scare.
Strange left support for CIA coup or these types
exactly.
of activities.
It's an unholy alliance between the left and the right supporting this kind of deep state activity. Look, all we need to remind ourselves of as progressives is the incredible human damage and tragedy that has resulted around the world when the CIA does take actions against democracies. You know, going back in the Cold War era, which I write about in The Devil's Chessboard, in Iran, the overthrow of the democratic government there, Guatemala, and on through Chile and Allende, up to Honduras during the Obama administration. These are all terrible events that result in years of suffering. They tend to leach into the future for many years where democratic governments are replaced by authoritarian regimes. Human rights is crushed. Economic progress is halted. Massive transfers of wealth to the tiny elites at the top and great suffering below. So that's what coups bring us when agencies like the CIA intervene in the political process. So is that what we want in this country? It's insane. And as short-sighted, as cavalier and cynical, as I say.
Peter Dale Scott, you want to chime in here?
No, I entirely agree with this. People who talk this way are talking about the dangers of Trump versus the dangers of the deep state, and both are dangerous. But, you know, at the same time, I'm not as pessimistic as that sounds, because I think that there's still potential from good to come out of both sides, too. And the piece I just wrote for Who, What, Why, I said Trump versus the deep state, that's how the light gets in. I stole a line, actually, from David, who in turn stole it from Leonard Cohen. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Well, this is very true right now, that the system is cracking. And we're getting messages from the CIA's journalists in the LA Times, New York Times,
Washington Post,
that it's very dangerous when the system is cracking. And I disagree. I think it's very American for the system to crack. I think this has been true over the years. We have had it, of course, with Watergate, and at the time it looked like a horrible mess. But we got the post-Watergate reforms, and we've been losing them recently, but I think we should try and get them all back.
But we also got the Pike and Church commissions.
Oh, yes. All kinds of things happened as a result of that. And, for example, it exposed at the very end that the CIA had been not just spying on the anti-war movement, but actually introducing provocateurs into the anti-war movement, so that it ended up, the cracks ended up with restoration of the needed limitations
but
on power.
But I think there is a difference between that period when the cracks did let in the light in the 1970s, after anti-war movement and strong movements from below were pushing a government to become more transparent. And as a result, there were these congressional hearings, as you say, in Washington that exposed many of the dark deeds of the CIA, not all of them, as we know, but many of them. But I think the difference today is both sides at war here, the Trump oligarchy, as I put it, and the deep state, are both deeply invested in lies and deception and fake news and alternative facts. We know the intelligence system, that's their tradecraft, and the people who are now flocking on air every night, the so-called liberal channels, even MSNBC, Rachel Maddow show, all the shows on MSNBC are now devoted 24/7 to anti-Russian propaganda. And virtually all of their guests are tied to the deep state, these national security agencies. And on the other hand, you have the Trump people who lie for a living as well. So really, in the clash between these behemoths, I call it Godzilla versus Mothra, because it's hard to say who we should support, and democracy is being crushed in between. I'm not sure that there's a lot of light coming out of this clash.
Peter Dale Scott.
Okay, maybe not right now, but obviously history is always changing, and that's, in fact, a sign of the health of American democracy, that it isn't really stuck in any kind of mode, but is always evolving. And as you pointed out, we do not now have a very strong anti-war movement that we had then, but we do have a new asset that we didn't have back then, and that's the internet. And I agree with you about not only the mainstream media, but even all the new things that we have thanks to technology that people can just press a button and listen to or watch. But it is much easier for people like you and I to share our ideas now. And if Trump is going to really follow through on all the things that he's threatening to do, we may not have a mass movement today, but I'll bet you in 2 or 3 years we will.
You're listening to the Project Censored show. I'm Mickey Huff. We're talking with Peter Dale Scott and David Talbot, and we're discussing the deep state and its trajectory, many of the ramifications of it. We're going to be getting into later that it's not a monolithic entity, of course. But riffing on this, David Talbot, you brought up alternative facts and fake news, and certainly fake news is nothing new. At Project Censored, we've been looking at the problems of propaganda, censorship, misinformation, disinformation for 40 years. So this is definitely not new. But what's new, and I think with Peter Dale Scott saying the crack and the shining of the light, it's becoming increasingly obvious to more people, it seems, in the United States that there is something deeply wrong with the direction that things are taking. For example, had Trump not been elected, we wouldn't have seen all these millions of people in the streets and the Women's March and all of the things that have been going on. They would have likely been somnambulistically rolling along underneath a Hillary Clinton presidency.
I think that the left and the progressive movements in general went to sleep under Obama, and I think that long sleep would have continued under Hillary Clinton as president. And so, yes, Trump has forced the issue in so many ways now, has forced people to rouse themselves from their slumber and take action. Going back to this discussion about whether or not light is coming in as a result of these fractures in the deep state and the daily hue and cry we see now, I think it's more smoke, really, than light. Again, back in the 70s, when you had a massive anti-war movement, when you had a post-Watergate reform movement that elected a number of progressive politicians to Congress, you did have an accountability there to the American people that's missing now. Unfortunately, what we have now is WikiLeaks instead, for good and ill. I have a very complex view of Julian Assange. I think he's a complex figure, and I think he's done an enormous amount of good and enormous amount of perhaps negative things as well. The point about Julian is that he's unaccountable. He's virtually a one-man show, and it's not hard to say who his sponsors are or who his sources are. They have to remain hidden, often for obvious reasons. So there he is operating, unfortunately, in captivity in the Ecuadorian embassy in London because of the U.S. and its efforts to get its hands on him. That may be different now under Trump. Who knows, because of the changing ideology of the American government. But in any case, we're kind of dependent on him for the light these days more and more. And he is not someone that is accountable. There's no editorial board, as far as I know, reviewing his decisions. There's no staff of investigative reporters working with him whose professional resumes we know about. He's a shadowy figure. And again, what he's revealed has been very important in many ways, including the leaks recently about the CIA hacks. This is kind of a thin reed for us to defend our democracy with at this point. We need something much bigger. We need a popular movement in this country, not a fake populism like Trump's, but a real populism. We saw inklings of that with the Bernie Sanders movement. Of course, now the media is completely focused away from Bernie and his issues that he was bringing up, the urgent issues of political reform and the corruption of our political system. That's gotten swept under the rug by all this Russian hysteria. So again, the media is, you know, again, doing a great disservice to the American people, just the way they did during the election, by focusing on the latest Trump tweet and not focusing on the issue.
If I could say, David, we have to be careful that we don't overfocus ourselves. And I essentially agree with everything you said about Assange, but I don't attribute as much importance as you do to his role in this thing. I think the Trump-Russia issue, which is huge, and we couldn't begin to adequately deal with it in 1 hour here, but it doesn't really all depend on Assange. It has its own dialectics, and it comes back to the leaks that are coming not via Assange, but by other sources from the intelligence community. I think that they did hear very disturbing things. The NSA picked up messages, and some stuff came to us from Assange. But even if we hadn't had Assange, we would still have, I think, this Trump-Russia issue. And I think it's huge, and I think it's going to generate its own series of leaks and counter-leaks and investigations.
And so that's the problem, I think, Peter, is that you have politics by leaks. And the American people are unable to really determine independently the credibility of these leaks on both sides. I actually happen to think there is some truth on the latest charges and countercharges here. On the one hand, I do believe that Trump and his circle probably did have contacts with Russia during the campaign. We know that. And they probably continue to in ways that are not serving our nation. On the other hand, I believe Trump's charges, there's some truth to that, too, that there was a massive effort by the surveillance agencies to surveil him during the campaign. We do know that two requests were made for FISA warrants by the Obama administration. I'm not sure why the media keeps saying there's no evidence that Trump himself was hacked by the Obama administration. We've seen this. There's reports on this. Trump is overstating it, as is his way, but obviously there's some truth on both sides. The point is, though, that this is a war of leaks and counterleaks that is, often a huge distraction. We're unable to really determine their validity in an independent way. And so what you have is a shadow war going on that is not democratic. It's not open debate based on open facts and transparency. It's a war of spooks.
We've also had, as a part of this whole dialectical process, we had the day after Trump's inauguration, the largest global demonstration that there has ever been. It was the first time you could really say that a global public opinion had been aroused by the dangers that we now face. And I think that's just a harbinger. That's the first bird in the springtime, that we're going to see so much more of this coming from all kinds of communities. The health community about the repeal of Obamacare, the scientific community about attempts to deny the reality of global warming. You're going to see all kinds of mobilizations. You're going to get, I think, if things go as they should go, there should be more and more coalescing of these diverse forces, not just in America. This is a global problem now. I believe that Putin and Trump both are trying to destroy the European Union. They're putting money behind Putin, certainly, putting money behind nationalists in France and Austria and Hungary. It's a very alarming situation, but I'm not scared because it's also a very provocative situation which will, I think, produce, as history always does, a countervailing movement. And sometimes things have to be shaken up like this in order to get the kind of progress that we've, all of us, you and I and Mickey and people, have been waiting for years. When are we going to do something about a system that's being essentially derailed?
Peter Dale Scott and David Talbot, I wanted to chime in that also on an optimistic front, potentially. It's hard to see sometimes optimistic fronts when we're in milieu and in crisis. And I've been using the phrase epistemological crisis, the way that phrases like deep state are being bandied about and fake news are being bandied about.
Right.
I think that it's very abusive to our language, of course. As Oxford Dictionary said last year, the phrase or word of the year was post-truth. But what's coming out of this, I think, coming back to Peter Dale Scott, is that I am seeing, Peter Phillips and I, Nolan Higdon, we're in the college classrooms and at Project Censored, we're on 20 campuses. We're seeing amazing amounts of mobilization among millennials. And these people are not buying it. They are not buying the fake news meme. It's in fact making them more interested in information integrity, critical media literacy. They're asking questions now about what does this mean, deep state? Right. And so, 2007, Peter, that word started to become more of something you used. Right.
I used it 2006.
But now we're seeing it everywhere. And curiously, even a few years ago, we barely saw it at all. And I'm less interested in the moniker than all that it describes underneath, going back to people like C. Wright Mills.
Yeah. Right. And if I could say, even fake news, I'm not at all sorry to see people talking about fake news, because if you start thinking about it, then you go back to the fact that the day after Oswald was shot and 3 days after Kennedy was shot, the CIA was already pumping out stories about how Oswald had been to Russia and tried to go to Cuba and was a disgruntled leftist. And it was propaganda. It was fake news.
Of course, the corporate media is now using this whole new debate about the deep state and conspiracy and so forth and tying it around Steve Bannon's neck and Donald Trump's neck, and therefore kind of discrediting the whole notion all over again and saying, look, this is the province of the kooky Trump world.
Mm-hmm. They're
right.
More on the defensive now.
I'm just saying that's their pushback. But look, at the end of the day, it's not the sort of war of the titans that's going to save American democracy. It's what we were saying earlier that happened in the 60s and 70s when you had these massive movements, people in the streets, people challenging authority and on civil rights and the war in Vietnam. And it wasn't just Senator Church in Congress and Walter Cronkite on CBS saying, look, you know, we've got to end the war in Vietnam. We've got to reform our government. It was hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people demanding this. And that's what we desperately need today. And we're starting to see signs that the American people are waking up. I once interviewed Chris Hedges, who, of course, was the great journalist who covered for the New York Times the falls of these dictatorships and these societies coming apart in Eastern Europe, the fall of communism and afterwards. And he said that often these governments, these regimes, are like dead men walking. They're dead, but they continue walking for a while before they finally collapse. I'm actually starting to think of the American regime and the power elite and what we've been talking about, the deep state here, in a similar way. I think the system is so obviously corrupt and so obviously ineffectual and really brain dead and unable to really deliver on any substantial needs for the American people, that it is a kind of a cadaver. It's a corpse that's already on its way out. It's just that the collapse could be even more disastrous. You never know what political direction a society can go in as it starts to come apart. So it's important for us, the American people, to come together, to have strong leadership. I don't believe, like Occupy, that anarchy is the direction we need to go. We need to have structured, and we need to take power back in this country and run people for office at the local, state, and national level and begin to take our country back. And with that, Peter and Mickey, I'm afraid I have to jump off.
Indeed.
Because I'm on a tight deadline.
That's the voice of David Talbot, author most recently of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. We're talking about the American deep state. We're joined, of course, also by Peter Dale Scott. I'd like to remind the listeners you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. We're going to continue our conversation on the American deep state with Peter Dale Scott after this brief musical break. And David Talbot, thank you kindly for joining us on the Project Censored Show today. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today's program, we're looking at the deep state in America. And last half hour, we were joined by David Talbot. He is the author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. He's also a columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle. We're also joined by Peter Dale Scott, author of The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. Peter Dale Scott remains with us for the rest of the program. Again, gentlemen and scholars both, Peter Dale Scott and David Talbot. So it's an honor to have them back on the Project Censored Show. So Peter Dale Scott, let's chime in where we left off. Right. David Talbot was talking about the responses to this and mobilizing movements and so forth. So what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I agree very strongly with something that David said just before the break, which is that Occupy was not a good model because they offered anarchy. A leaderless movement is not the answer to what this country needs. It has to be organized. It has to be disciplined. But I think you're not going to have a movement that will persuade America and capture American support unless it is nonviolent. And I think we have to be very clear about this. The civil rights movement was successful in the South because it was amazingly nonviolent in the face of incredible provocations and actual deaths. You know, people were being killed and they went
on. Freedom rides and so forth. Yeah, absolutely.
And they went on being nonviolent. I think that we have to be careful that we don't fight the last war, those of us who are progressives. And I think that there were two big mistakes in the anti-war movement. The first one is not so much mistake, but a limitation because of what was available then. We're not going to change this country in the streets. We were able to stop the Vietnam War in the streets, but you know that very victory meant that Oliver North and a whole bunch of people started planning very seriously how to make sure that a movement in the streets would never do that again. Oliver North actually testified. He said, "We didn't lose the war in Vietnam. We lost it right here in this city." And that's what the core of the planning, they planned for warrantless detention, warrantless surveillance. And you can actually find online the Army handbook on the detention camps. They had a 10-year program called Project Endgame. It started right after 9/11 when COG was introduced, continuity of government. And the budget for 1 year alone was $400 million. They really put a lot of effort. They're already, if we get a big movement in the streets like there was against the Iraq War in 2003, they're ready with all kinds of militarized equipment.
They just shut it down at Standing Rock.
Yes, yes. We saw an example of it at Standing Rock. The really very ugly equipment that blasts your eardrums. There was a no-fly zone at Standing Rock so that the press would not be able to go fly over in their helicopters.
Or drones.
Or drones and see what was happening. It became off-limits to the media. The system, the deep political system, is organized to deal with the old-fashioned form of protest. And I believe very strongly that not only do we need a movement that is disciplined, I think it needs to be very decentralized. We have to see centers of activism build up within our institutions, within the universities, within the healthcare system, among the scientists of NASA and other places. As these people are being threatened, and by the way, you know, the threat to the scientific community, I think, is very real and a very big part of this threat that we're dealing with. We had a Trump in Canada for 10 years, a man called Stephen Harper, and what they did was really criminal. They took over agencies and immediately ordered the destruction of files that went back for decades, scientific data was destroyed.
Well, we were seeing that threat of that here.
Yes, and we should anticipate it and make sure it cannot succeed. But that means there has to be organization. And the overall idea is you organize within specific industries, communities. You know, David was very gloomy about Washington. I think there are a lot of good people still in Washington, and they're very skilled at taking care of themselves. You cannot begin to define all the things that are going to happen in the next 4 years, but I think it's going to be after a relatively sleepy period under Obama, it's going to be a very active period and should be. And the point, coming back to the importance of the split between Trump and the deep state, it's a crude way of putting it, but there's something real behind it. And light will be shed. And of course, light by itself is no good unless you do something. If the light doesn't help arouse protests at what's being revealed, then it's a waste of time. But I think this is a country which is very good at responding to the truth when it leaks out. And if there's a gap between what the truth is and what the government is saying it is, either side in this dispute, then the people have to stand up and fight for truth. As Milton said centuries ago, the voice of reason and truth is a small voice, but in the long run, it will be heard. I've seen a great deal since Trump was elected, a great deal of anger, that's okay, a great deal of hatred, not so good, a great deal of despair, and I think despair is the most dangerous of all. There is no reason to despair. Let me say, things were pretty desperate back in the time of Joe McCarthy, which I remember very vividly. And people wondered, are we going to become like the Soviet Union? And of course, we didn't. And the Joe McCarthy era was a very bad era out of which good things happened. We got a bunch of very good Supreme Court rulings which defanged the anti-communism that wasn't just Joe McCarthy by any means. It was the FBI. It was inside the State Department. It was all over the place. But we outgrew it. I thought nothing could be worse than the election and the re-election of Richard Nixon. Well, things have been worse since then, but it was bad, and we outgrew the crisis of that period. Every country in the world, if they're a big power, they're a flawed power, because power corrupts. There's a great deal of power in here and in Russia and in China and in India, and power corrupts, and all these societies are corrupt in various ways. But I would say in terms of fighting the corruption, dealing with corruption, I think America's still out ahead of the others. It's deeply flawed, but it's also very conscious of its flaws, and that's what you need. And so I have a phrase that, yes, we should protest, we do, but, you know, in the old days, I saw it in Berkeley in the 60s and 70s, these people hated America. They always spelled it with three Ks instead of a C. And they wanted not to improve the country, they wanted to smash the system, which was insanity. I mean, Nixon was insane too, but it was insane to think that if you destroyed the system, something good would come out of it because people would start starving to death. We cannot just go retire to our garden plots and support ourselves. No, it was crazy. And so we should not over-idealize. We should learn from the successes of the past, but we should learn that everything is flawed when it becomes powerful. And the anti-war movement, when it became powerful, was also flawed. So with all humility, we should learn from the past and have faith that this is a country where if you struggle for truth, you can make something happen.
Basically saying, like, we've been through times, we've been through trials and tribulations.
That's the advantage of being 88, you know. I'm used to seeing an appalling situation in Washington. It can be overcome.
Well, these appalling situations seem to get relatively or contextually worse in my half as much time on the planet as you've been. And so the Trump years kind of, you see, we get these lovely rewrites. So now in the Trump administration, we're seeing George W. Bush suddenly see some brief resurgence of, hey, remember the days of W. Bush weren't that bad. And of course, we saw the Nixon refurbishing.
Yes.
Right, when he
Reagan.
Died.
Reagan.
Real indeed.
His first 4 years, he was so, so anti-Russian. But in the end, he got so swayed by the rhetoric of Gorbachev that he terrified the advisors who were with him there in Reykjavik. That was a very important moment.
Indeed. Well, Peter Dale Scott, let's go to the deep state, because you've been following this for ages, but we've recently seen so many references to, quote, the deep state, that the definitions, where they seem to have flown out the window.
I don't think you can really define the deep state. The deep state is the indefinable excess of power that is not captured and limited in the Constitution. And that was the example, really, of Turkey, that they were describing something they didn't fully know about. And I think we're all in the same status. By the way, you know, I'm reissuing a paperback edition of The American Deep State, and a significant subtitle, well, now it used to be Wall Street Big Oil, and it's now going to be Big Money and Big Oil, because we have to deal precisely with awareness of a whole level of combat between very rich people, in which Wall Street is more like a faction than the whole. The old Wall Street is still there, and, you know, as I said in Who, What, Why, I think three of the past four Treasury secretaries, including Mnuchin, the new one for Trump, have come from Goldman Sachs. So fulfilling what Jeffrey Sachs had to say about Goldman Sachs, which is that there is an axis there, the axis that C. Wright Mills was talking about a half a century ago between Wall Street and Washington. It's still there. But this other faction, the Goldwater faction, which never really, by the way, became a serious faction in American power until something most people don't know about, which is the Halloween Massacre of October 31st, 1975. And it was engineered in the Ford administration by his chief of staff and his deputy. And those two men were Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. And if there was ever a coup d'etat, it was not illegal. It was just firing people. But some very significant things happened. William Colby, who had been collaborating with Congress about revealing CIA secrets, was fired. He was replaced by George H.W. Bush, who brought in something called Team B, who reassessed the Soviet threat and said it was far, far greater than what the experts have been saying, and it was also far, far greater than it really was. But it led to a huge expansion of the defense budget that really began under Carter, of all people, but is usually remembered as the Reagan budget increases, but it began under Carter. But the main thing is that that Goldwater faction, which is a real, it's not that they want the government to do something different. They don't like government. They don't want America to be governed. They want it, you know, one of those people said, I'd like to shrink.
Grover Norquist.
Yes, Norquist. I'd like to shrink the bureaucracy until we can drown it in a bathtub. And with all the problems we face with an increasingly complex society and increasingly heavy impact on the environment, we need government. Maybe Trump will clean up some things that we shouldn't have. I'm not saying it's going to be all bad, but the Goldwater idea that we can get along with just the armed forces and not much else, and maybe then they debate about whether you have Social Security or not. No, we need government. And there are times when the people have to step in, not just to restrain the government, but now, in essence, to preserve certain features. I mean, a lot of old radicals are now really cast in the role of conservatives. We're trying to conserve the Constitution. It's not an ideal Constitution, but it's better than the alternatives that are being proposed.
Or conserve the EPA,
yeah,
which came from Nixon.
All those institutions. But, you know, there's a threat now with 33 state legislatures in the control of the Republicans. There's the risk of a constitutional convention, and they may call it on one issue, but if you call it, it can do anything. And so... I mean, I too would like to change the Constitution in certain ways, but I don't trust the 33 Republican legislatures to give us a path to a better alternative. So that makes me a conservative, to my amazement.
Not a strange way of looking at it, however, right? When you can explain that. And it also, I think, helps people understand the many shifts or the shifting baselines.
Right. And I would like America, everyone listening to this broadcast, to share the concern that David and I and you, Mickey, have about where we are right now and see that it really is dangerous, but also to see that there are also possibilities arising out of this chaos. You know, Schumpeter said, creative destruction. And we're a bit in that kind of period. There is hope out of all this, and we should really much shouldn't be focusing on the despair, because it's very easy. I certainly understand people who despair. Some very close friends of mine are really despairing, and they won't listen to an 88-year-old who say it's been bad before. But there's also hope, and you have to see. I think the fact that tacitly in Syria, we are not now trying to unseat Assad. We are trying to get rid of ISIS. I don't like American troops in the Middle East at all, but if they're going to be there, this is a better target. And even from the very beginning, when ISIS was threatening to seize the capital of Kurdistan in northern Iraq, I approved of the drone attacks and the Air Force attacks that blunted that effort. I don't say that American power is always wrong, wherever it is, but there's far too much of it and in far too many countries, and we are quietly escalating the U.S. attacks in Yemen, Somalia. I mean, I'm not even up to date in how many countries we're fighting in now. That's how bad it is, and it's a sign of a system that's gone berserk. And in my book, by the way, I talk about how the Pax Britannica worked reasonably well at the beginning, but it became too powerful and very excessive, and it actually produced the tensions that resulted in World War One. We do not want Samaritana to produce the tensions that will result in World War III. That would really negate all of the positive things that have been achieved in making a more peaceful and global world. There have been real achievements, and particularly technical achievements. The internet is such a promising thing, but everyone should know that if we have put enough people in the streets, they have the plans ready to push a button and close it down. And they can do it selectively, just in California, or they can do it nationally. That's the kind of threat we face, and that's why we need a different kind of opposition now that is multi-based in many places, is working within the system, trying to preserve and improve the system, not to smash the system.
We need a truly free press in order to encourage and support all of these kinds of attempts.
Yes, well, we need open communications in an open society. We certainly do.
Well, Peter Dale Scott, your recent articles can be found over at Russ Baker's site, whowhatwhy.org. And you actually have a two-part series of articles that listeners can check out. It's called Donald J. Trump and the Deep State, Parts 1 and 2. And in fact, you conclude the part 2 of these pieces on a note that's very similar to this when you say, so many times before in U.S. history, we're entering another period of divisions and protests. But a successful protest of the nonviolent kind you hope for, and this is what you have been writing in your books, right, that must be inspired by deeply critical love of this flawed country and not by hatred. It's an honor to have you back on the program. Peter Dale Scott, author of so many books and important articles, one crucially related to this conversation. Of course, The Road to 9/11 is one, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America. But the other, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. We were joined earlier on the program.
Can I just throw in one more?
Please.
Also at Who, What, Why, my very latest piece just a couple of days ago, Trump versus the Deep State, : that's how the light gets in.
Indeed.
Quoting from Leonard Cohen.
And we were joined earlier by journalist David Talbot, author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. Thanks so much to the guests today on the program, and thank you, Peter Dale Scott.
Well, thank you, Mickey, and thanks to Project Censored. You do a very valuable service for this country.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
You've been listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. Executive producers, myself, Mickey Huff, along with Peter Phillips. Our producer is Anthony Fest, and Erica Bridgman is our engineer. The Project Censored show airs on roughly 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Political minds, political.
political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise another guise of democracy, politics of the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous, so the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity, citizens hypnotized by the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers and our sisters.